Welcome to Binge-topia. We hope you enjoy your stay.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Binge-topia.
Hello and welcome back.
I'm Julia Hava.
I'm Eliza McLam.
If you would like to support the podcast on Patreon and get our bonus episodes, our monthly Zooms, and our reading list, you can go to patreon.com/binge-topia and subscribe.
And if you'd like to support us for free, you can leave us a little review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Click those five little stars. Write us a nice little thing. We appreciate it. It's like probably the number one thing you can do other than showing the podcast to a friend. That really helps us out to grow the pod.
We almost have 1,000 reviews.
Yeah, which Apple. Would be really... So who's going to be our 1,000th review?
Who's going to be our 1,000th review?
Also, just some of you need to pay more attention to the part at the beginning where we go, I'm Julia Hava, I'm Eliza McLam, because I ran a poll on the podcast Instagram and asked how many of you could tell our voices apart, and over 500 of you said you cannot.
Which is also like, I don't think our voices sound that similar.
I don't think so either. Sounds like sexism to me.
Well, they don't. And then also people will like be like, when Julia said this, and I'm like, I didn't say that. And they'll be like, when Eliza said this, I'm like, guys, at this point, you got to learn.
It's true. And like, we aren't a monolith. We do agree on, we do disagree on some things.
Yeah.
It's important to know who holds what positions.
And also, like, it was funny because somebody was like, oh, Eliza, you're in like psychology grad school. And I was like, I feel like
I'm not.
She's not.
And somebody was like, Eliza, when you were like, I feel so old being 25. It's like, it's podcast lore that I'm the baby.
It's weird, though, because it seems like people think that, like, I haven't gotten a bunch of things being like, oh, like, Julia, when you said this and it was something you said. I think people think that, like, you're.
That I'm you?
That you're me.
Yeah.
Because it's been people that say like, oh, when Eliza said this, and it's actually something that I said.
Right.
But I haven't gotten things that like you said that people think it's me talking.
I don't know what that says about the pod, but y'all need to turn your listening ears on.
You need to turn your listening ears on. We're burning a candle right now. I've become a candle head. I'm like,
yeah, this is a new candles. One.
Yeah, this one is Boy Smells. It's called Redhead. I really like it.
I love Boy Smells. Also, I just turned 21, so I'm
happy
officially
birthday.
Thank you. And so all the drunk histories or herstories from now on will be fully kosher. But yeah, 21. And Julia got me a beautiful candle.
Do you like the candle?
I am obsessed with the candle.
Isn't she gorgeous?
She's gorgeous. She smells amazing. What is it? It's
okay, so the candle is from the brand Overose, and it's called Nudes, and it's roses and rain. Look, you guys might look at the price of that candle and be like, why would you spend that much on a candle? And I just have to say, now that I've become a candle head, a candle is something that you, for some reason, if you want a good candle, you're gonna have to spend a little money on.
A candle is something that can be so personal, and I love that candle. Like, and the other thing is too,
it's
like
strong, the throw, that's what they call it, like the throw. This candle was like $30 or $35, and the throw is not as strong as the Nudes one.
Yeah, I mean, and I live in a tiny studio apartment, and I light it and literally like 6 minutes later I blow it out and the whole apartment smells beautiful like roses and rain for like 3+ hours. It's great.
The problem with candles is that you have to burn them until they're liquid all on the edges.
Yeah.
And that's something people forget.
Wow. I actually didn't know that. Thank you, my candle headstress.
Then they tunnel.
They tunnel, yeah.
And you're wasting candle.
Right.
So you have to pick like a time that you're like, all right, I guess I'm going to be here for 3 hours to like light this candle. Or you can put tinfoil around the edges and then it will like all burn.
Wow. What prompted you into this lifestyle?
Well, honestly, a long time ago, I was listening to Laura Marie Shainhall's second podcast, which no longer exists, but it's called Babe, and she had this whole like series of episodes where she just reviewed candles with Ed Drosty, who's like the lead singer of Grizzly Bear, that band, who's like her friend, and they just like reviewed candles and
love.
They were like really going into the candles, and she was the one who recommended Nudes, Overose, and Rain by Field Apothecary, which is the other one that I have that Lucas is obsessed with. And so she was talking about, I didn't even know that there was like a market for candles, but then I went to this place called Candle Delirium in Hollywood. I was going there. I didn't end up getting your present there because they didn't have the brands that I wanted. So I went to this place called Scent Bar where they have other candles. But they have like these insane, really expensive, like $200 candles from Sierra Trudon, which is like the first candle company, I guess. They were like making candles for Versailles. And they are insane. They're so expensive and you smell them and you're like, that is not a scent that I've smelled before. It is like very, like there's a whole candle market out there.
Wow.
And so when you buy an expensive candle, I guess there's a way that you're supposed to take care of it.
Yeah.
You're supposed to like trim the wick so that, 'cause otherwise the flame goes too high.
Wow.
And you have to monitor your candles because you can't just leave a candle burning.
It's true. You can't just leave a candle burning.
Yeah. And so that's my candle journey. If anybody wants to send us a candle, if anybody wants to send us a candle to review,
we should set up a PO box,
because I really like should.
I would write little
if you
letters.
Want us to review something.
Oh yeah, if you want us to review something. Yeah. Yeah, that would be great.
But I have to stop buying candles because otherwise I'm going to spend too much money on candles. But I do love a candle. I will say, if you're looking, the Boy Smells ones are not too expensive and yeah. they're really nice.
Rhubarb Smoke is a fave of mine. That's a Boy Smells one.
Yeah, but I started out with PF Candle, which is like really cheap candles.
Yeah.
And there's one called Golden Hour that's really nice, and it comes in like a cool little retro case. And yeah. that one's really, it's honestly a really nice candle as well.
Yeah, and you can use the code MIMI20 to get 20% off. Can I tell the MIMI20 yeah, story? Okay, so for a while, our good friend John was, you already know some John lore if you're subscribed to the Patreon, because you've heard about his and Lucas's affair with the Euphoria cast, but our friend John was seeing this woman named Mimi, and I had only known of her, I met her like 4 months after knowing her name, because she was known colloquially around the house as Mimi 20.
Well, because we have another friend named Mimi right. who was my roommate in college, and so she was Mimi.
Right, we're not just needlessly objectifying random women.
No.
Also, Mimi 20 works at PF Candle. That's her code. Also, you...
I don't know if we're allowed to give people her code, but like, Mimi, we take full responsibility for giving people your code.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe she gets a percentage off of it. It has to be like an affiliate. So like, let's give Mimi 20 her coin, because... I was in the park with Kate writing our wills, as I talked about previously, and we needed somebody to sign it as a witness. It would be valid in California. And there's this like beautiful woman sitting on the grass with like a bunch of other people. And we walk up and we're like, hey, will somebody sign our will? And she immediately is like, absolutely. I write a will every year. I'm so enthused to do that. We're like, great, queen, thanks. And then, yeah, her
that
name.
That woman.
And then that woman.
Was Mimi 20.
And that woman was Mimi 20. So Mimi 20 has been an important force in our lives.
She's the queen of Los Angeles.
She is the queen of Los Angeles. Give her her flowers.
She's very powerful. And so, yeah, PF Candles are good. If you guys have other candle recommendations, please let me know. But I used to just like, oh my God, remember when like Yankee Candle was a thing?
Oh my God, flop.
I think those are actually also expensive, but they're like yeah, gross.
They're not good. Oh my God, I remember this one time I was at Marshall's like standing in the candle aisle, as is my white woman right. And there were like, it was around the holidays, and there were candles that were like mac and cheese and like ew. Chicken pot pie. And it's like, why the fuck would I want that?
And also, I do think that it's good to get like a soy blend candle, because I think other ones are like toxic and can release yeah. like toxic fumes. I don't know.
I mean, I have to be careful with the cats, because right. the cats aren't like, I mean, it's not going to kill your cat if you like
I
burn
it's
a bad
specifically
candle.
Specifically essential oils that you can.
So sometimes candles are made with essential oils, but the more expensive ones often are not. Mm. They're like more, you know, complicated compounds than that. And you know, the one that you got me, I literally only burned for 6 minutes and then it's good to go. So I'm not really worried
that's
about
that. That's crazy that you should keep burning it though.
I know
need
I need
to make it even.
I know, but then I would like get a headache because my apartment is so small that like there's only so many places for the scent to go.
Interesting.
But let's talk about the culture.
Let's talk about the culture. You guys are tired of hearing us talk about candles.
I need to talk about Caleb from West Elm.
Okay, yeah. I don't have TikTok anymore, but I've heard
about
this.
I don't either. And I know that it's a big deal in the culture because it has transpired to Twitter, which is where I
heard
about
it. If it's on Twitter and BuzzFeed, then it's like everyone knows.
So, Julia, what do you know about Caleb from West Elm?
I know that there's some dude named Caleb who, first of all, extremely triggering name. He was like some dude that all these girls in New York City kept matching with, and I guess he was a furniture designer at West Elm, and uh-huh. he just like kept ghosting them. I don't really know.
Yeah. So basically, like, this one girl posted this TikTok about going on a date with a Caleb from West Elm. Somebody else responded or like commented on the TikTok and was like, oh my God, no way. Like, I feel like I'm like kind of casually dating Caleb from West Elm, and he told me he deleted Hinge or something.
Queen, I promise you, you're not casually dating Caleb. He is right. fully seeing other
right.
women.
So now there's like a whole, like there's a bunch of girls who are like, oh my God, like he all sent us the same playlist and he like said the same stuff and he like ghosted me after two dates. And then somebody made this really unhinged video that was like, this is the problem with love bombing men and like this is abuse and all of this stuff, which is where TikTok always goes under any slight discomfort. And so I made a tweet, like kind of subtweeting about the whole situation, that was something like, you guys are not allowed to use the word love bombing anymore. Getting ghosted after the second date builds character. Like, it buck does. Up, ladies. Like, literally, like, strengthen your faculties.
Shout out to the queens who have gotten ghosted after the second date many times.
Yeah. Hi. I'm a repeat offender on both sides, by the way. So justice for people who ghost as well.
Honestly, same.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, I think the problem is you don't like casual dating, because if you're expecting a guy after like one or two dates to like fully commit to you and like cut off everybody and like, okay, yeah, it's kind of fuckboy behavior to ghost or to send playlists. But men
like say the same shit to every woman anyway. Yes. Like, he's not unique.
Oh, he's running back the jokes. He's running back the songs. He like learned all the songs from his ex-girlfriend anyway. So like, I don't know why we're all up in a tizzy. It's just like, it was so, like, seeing people describe that as, like, love bombing or abuse, it's like, this is just genuinely disrespectful to people who, because love bombing is a thing, it's real, but
a lot of these things are not psychologically, like, proven phenomenon.
And it's just, like, a facet of modern dating that, like, yeah, you just kind of have a bunch of people on rotation, like, nothing's that serious, and you just kind of, like, cut people loose as you're no longer interested in them. That sucks. I can get how it feels dehumanizing, but, like, end of the day, you're not, like, a victim of anything.
It's not like a unique situation,
right? It's not a phenomenon.
Finding a man in New York City that's like an asshole, not shocking or groundbreaking,
right? Sorry, we've all been there.
Yeah, we've all been there. I like your socks.
Thank you.
Where are those socks from?
I think they're from urban. Actually has really cute socks.
Interesting. They're cute little white socks with red flowers on them.
Yeah, I like them. I got new shoes recently too. I got really? Yeah, I got Converse, because Converse is making platforms, and I famously never wear a shoe without a platform, because I feel like if I do, they make my feet look tiny and my legs look big, and it's just, like, something I'm uncomfortable with.
Interesting.
Out of principle. It's not true. It's a weird, like, body dysmorphia thing, I'm sure, but I just am terrified of buying a shoe without a platform. That being said, Converse has really cute platform shoes that I like a lot.
Interesting.
But yeah, there was West Elm Caleb Gate, and then fucking... the wedding ring.
Oh yeah, so we talked about Machine Gun Kelly and Megan Fox on last week's episode. Now it has been revealed that her ring has thorns in it, so if she tries to remove it, it hurts because, quote, love is painful.
Yeah, truly psychotic behavior.
Which is also like, what if you have to like take it off because you're like getting an x-ray or
she's
something.
She's an actress. She's gonna have to take it off all the time.
It's like, just like every time you take it off.
That's some shit in like a sci-fi movie or something.
Well, I've really been trying to think about this, because how does it not hurt her when she's wearing it, but it hurts her if she tries to take it off? That's what I don't understand.
You know, in parking lots, sometimes when you pull out and it has those little stakes and it's like, do not back up, this will ruin your tires.
Yeah.
Like if it's on and it's stagnant, like maybe they just go in one direction. So if it's being taken off in the other direction, you know what I'm saying?
Interesting.
Like if she has it on and the spikes are pointing towards her fingertip, then when she takes it off it's painful, but if she slips it on it goes the other way,
you know? Sociopath behavior.
Yeah, truly. I mean, it's, I don't understand the mechanics of it, and I have no desire to. It sounds insane.
Yeah.
And then what else is on the docket? I had other things.
You wanted to talk about Sienna May.
Oh yeah, I did want to talk about Sienna May, who I've never really liked, even before I had reason not to like her. And this is like, we don't usually talk about like teenage hype house TikTok. Actually, that's a fucking lie. We talk about teenage hype house TikTok drama all the time. But basically, if you're uninitiated, did you watch Jack Wright's video?
Yeah, I just watched it before you came. So basically, Sienna May is this TikToker who got famous because she like is really hot. And then in one video, it zoomed out and showed that she had a stomach and she has fat on her body. And everybody was like, queen, thank you so much for normalizing fatties.
Yeah.
She was like, you're welcome.
By the way, this girl was like at her heaviest maybe like a size 8. Like,
yeah, she's like, literally just curvy.
Yeah. And then after she got popular for being like a body positive queen, she lost like 20 pounds or something.
She actually really did. That's so true. And then everybody would be like, thanks for making me eat today. I'm like, you guys need to stop placing your entire mental health on some random influencer.
Yeah, but I mean, all of those things, like, not a crime, like kind of weird to just like capitalize off of like the fat positive movement that was created by like women of color and actual fat people to, you know, make some money. Not crazy about that, but again, not a crime. And then something came out because she was like collaborating with Jack Wright, who is another TikToker. They did little like dances and stuff, from my understanding, and they were like friends.
I thought they were dating though, because in their videos they made it seem like they kind of do.
That was like a thing. They definitely did like tease that a lot. But then this one video, I remember over the summer, this one video came out of like him being like clearly passed out on a couch,
and her on top of him,
and like he like literally his body is limp, like it's very alarming and like really disturbing. He said something about like sexual assault, and then she like went kind of she went off on TikTok and was like yelling and being like
she was being really aggressive about it, she which is really kind aggressive. Of like
it's like, if you didn't do it,
why are you screaming?
Yeah. And then also the defense that she was using was really
she was
not...
like, he didn't tell me that he felt sexually assaulted.
Right. She was like, oh, well, if you really felt that way, why would you still be hanging out with me? Why would you still be like, that's classic, like abuser shit. But yeah, then recently, I think like 3 days ago, Jack Wright made like a long form video on YouTube where he details all, like he hadn't really talked about it explicitly, but he details all of the sexual assault, and it sounds terrifying.
She's insane. The stalking, she literally would just like walk into his house and like use the key card to like get into his house.
He was like, and it was really hard because like I didn't want to hurt her physically, so like there was kind of like I tried to really get her off of me, but like I really didn't want to hurt her, like I, and there could have been, I mean, not to, this isn't a common narrative, so I don't want to like feed into this, but like if he were to actually do anything that would physically harm her, she could really easily spin that. But I think it's really, really brave of him because he is, you know, a very prominent teenage male celebrity coming out about sexual assault by a woman, which is a very hard thing for men to talk about. Like, that's a real thing.
I mean, especially I would say with like older women too, that's like really like happens a lot. Like the whole, oh my God, what was her name? Mary Kay Letourneau, who was like an elementary school teacher, and she like slept with one of her like middle school students, maybe.
Oh God.
And then he got her pregnant, and then like she basically ruined his life because she was like, we're in love. Like insane shit like that. If you've seen a teacher on Hulu as well, that's kind of like an example of that. But it does happen with people who are the same age too. And I do think that like women just tend to think like, oh, men always want sex and like they're fine with it. And like,
yeah, and it's also harder to, I mean, obviously it's hard to identify sexual assault in any capacity. It's like ways in which it's uniquely hard for women, but like men really don't have a script for that.
I think most of the times when men talk about being sexually assaulted, it's by another man. So it's especially rare for men to say that like, I'm a straight man and this straight woman like assaulted me.
Yeah, especially when she's like beautiful and popular and loved by a lot of people. Like I can't imagine the strength and the bravery. Also in the video he pulled like other men had messaged him saying that she had done similar things to them, and so he was really like, you know, and it seems like he's getting a lot of support from people. It like sounds like he was like living in hell. Like he talked about like times where he had like planned to go on vacation and then like she planned to come like last minute like without his knowledge, and he just like dreaded it. Like it sounds really, really terrifying. And I'm happy that he's out at a place now where he's kind of out of it.
Yeah. The things he was saying, I was just like, damn, that girl is
She would like
insane.
Come to his house in the middle of the night and he would wake up and like her hand would like be on his crotch. Like that's so fucking scary.
Yeah. Especially she'd done it to other people too. It seems like that's just kind
of. Yeah. And like breaking down
she was so
doors. And
I don't know if she was like hulking into doors, but she definitely would. <yeah.
laughs> She's breaking down doors. Sorry.
But yes. Yeah. So props to him.
Yeah, props to Jack Wright. We're adding him to our male expanders list.
Yeah. True. What else did we want to talk about?
Oh, somebody messaged us saying that there's a community of TERFs on Tumblr who really love our podcast.
What?
And we're just here to say we are not for that.
And also,
we do not
like,
stand for you, queens.
Why are you a fan of us?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Did you listen to Panic at the Gender Performance?
I didn't even know Tumblr was still active, to be honest.
We're just here to say, in case you are confused, we're very anti-TERF.
Yeah, we're not TERFs.
Yeah, and so if you think that we are aligned with your ideology on that, we are absolutely unequivocally not, and you can go fuck yourself about it.
Yeah.
And just felt that that was important to say in case any wires were crossed along the way.
I was going to say something else. What was it? Oh, I was watching this show yesterday that was kooky. It's called House of Ho, and it's about this Vietnamese family that's like, it's a reality TV show, and like they're really wealthy, but like they named all their kids after U.S. presidents.
Okay.
So they're named like Washington, Lincoln, like McKinley, Roosevelt, like all of them. But then like they have one girl, and apparently she was a disappointment because she was a girl, so they just named her Judy. Like the rest of them are just... named after U.S. presidents. And then like there's like those kids and Judy, and then like they all have kids and they're also all named after U.S. presidents.
Damn, they're gonna run out at some point. They live during in Texas, some generation, which is
like very Texas vibes, but yeah. Like I'm just like, justice for Judy.
Yeah, justice for her. I'm trying to think if there's any president names that would be kind of cool as a girl's name.
I mean, McKinley's not bad. It's very like Southern,
right?
Kennedy is also Southern, but like
Taft, that would kind of be like
one of them's named too, which is like, you guys are definitely Republicans.
Yeah, I know there's some like non-binary person in Bushwick named Taft.
Wait, I'm trying to think of other presidents.
Literally mind blank.
I'm trying to just think if like there Bush. Are other Bushes would be a weird name.
Yeah.
Hoover, Roosevelt doesn't really go off like that.
Roosevelt could be kind of cute if it was but a girl.
Hoover
but
then, is,
yeah,
not a Herbie Hooves. Who else? What was that guy's name? Okay, I guess Hayes too. Rutherford B. Hayes. Like a lot of these names, I'm like, wait, people actually do name yeah. their children that.
Yeah.
It's just weird when you put them all together and all of them are named after presidents.
I feel like Theodore would kind of be a banging name for a girl if she went by Teddy.
But it's all specifically last
right,
names.
Right, last names, which is weird. Yeah, that is weird. That's really weird.
Grant. A lot of them are like, yeah, those are actually, names. I'm now thinking about it. Yeah. And then I bet you someone named their kid Obama.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I mean, people name their kid like Coney. Like
people name their kid Daenerys after Game of Thrones. Oh. And then they didn't wait to see how Game of Thrones ended in which she's the villain.
That's like, it's so much worse. It's like people getting a tattoo of like an artist and they turn out to be canceled or something.
Apparently,
like, that's your Halsey kid's name.
Has a tattoo of, what's his name? Marilyn Manson. Like a look up Halsey Marilyn Manson tattoo.
Okay. Okay, it's also not well done.
I actually haven't seen it. Can I see it? Oh, wait, it actually looks like it's like a melting face.
I mean, I get where the artist was coming from, but
imagine having a terrible tattoo and it's like an abuser.
Yeah, and it's huge. It like goes all the way down the right side of her body.
Flop.
That's really bad. That's really bad. What other celebrities have terrible tattoos?
I mean, definitely some celebs have like Chinese characters that are wrong. I mean, Ariana right. Grande's Japanese barbecue grill tattoo.
That was so iconic. What did she want it to say?
She wanted it to say seven rings.
It says barbecue grill.
Yeah, because I guess like the way it was laid out means right. barbecue grill.
She deserves that.
I was going to say, oh, you know something depressing?
What?
That I was just like, what? You know, like the new season of Cheer and how like one of them was like,
yeah, I was watching
porn.
It.
It's just like really a downer.
Yeah, it is a downer.
It's just always a downer because it's like, which does not make it okay, but like that person's definitely a victim themselves if like they're engaging in pedophilic behavior.
Right.
Like, it's a cycle that keeps on going, which does not excuse it whatsoever, but like it's just sad.
Yeah, you know? Cheer season one was like the best vibes, and Cheer season two, it's just kind of a dark shadow across.
It's really dark, and also apparently like the main cheer person was like not there, Monica or whatever, because she was on Dancing with the Stars. And she was like, I could not be there for the team because I was doing my like journey on Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah, they really are capitalizing off shit at every turn, which is crazy.
But like there's just insane abuse in like cheerleading yeah. and gymnastics.
Any
and, like,
type of sport that's like contingent on like young people really working their bodies in any significant way. Like,
ugh.
I think, just a brief thing about Yellow Jackets, which I'm watching. It's good.
It's so good.
You guys should watch it. The only thing that's, well, I guess I won't say this because it's like kind of a spoiler.
Why is it a spoiler?
Well, I was totally with it until it seems like it's like incorporating elements of the supernatural, which I'm like,
right. A lot of people are saying that, which I get, but also like, it's just a crazy show.
Yeah. But it's like a plane crash with like girls surviving the wilderness is like interesting enough.
That's also Lost. Like Lost also has a plane crash and then it's like supernatural.
Yeah.
Elements.
And then it flopped once it started getting supernatural.
I mean, I agree with that. I don't like a supernatural element.
Yeah.
Speaking of Yellow, I watched the first episode of Yellowstone yesterday.
Nice.
Which is an
in.
Insane show. And I'm, as you guys know, I've mentioned 1883 in literally every episode since I started watching it, which is the prequel. And now you're seeing like their fucked up family after they like colonized all the land in Montana or whatever. But it's interesting because there's like a lot of Native American characters in it. And it's like about like the tensions between like the reservation land and like the land that this family has. It's an interesting show. I've only seen one episode, but there are a lot of horses in it as well, which I support. I love horses, not like in a horse girl way. I just love to see horses like frolicking through a field.
Yeah, of course. I mean, your demeanor changed entirely when you're like, and also there are horses as well.
I just love like a horse like being free.
Yeah. Oh, me too. Me too.
And like, I don't like horses in like the weird like British riding sense where you're wearing like a weird hat and like you're wearing like those boots and like they're like jumping over things. The Western riding is really cool where you're just like on a saddle, the horse is running through the desert. And like, I have ridden a horse before and I understand why they have horse therapy, because there is something that's like very therapeutic or about like, I'm just on this animal and it's just in charge of me.
I do not agree. I feel that actually I should go to therapy because I have ridden a horse.
Really? Did you have a bad experience with a horse?
No, it's just they're so scary.
But not if you get a nice horse.
But I just, like, I'm afraid. Like, I remember when I went to Jesus camp, they put me on a fucking horse.
It depends on the horse, though.
I was cobbling through, like, the... No, and my horse is really nice because I was, like, freaking out. And they're like, let's give you, like, the nicest, gentlest horse. It just doesn't matter. Like, I'm cobbling through the wilderness. It's, like, wet. The horse is stepping on stones. And I just feel like we're going to both come down the hill. Always going too fast.
Yeah, no, as somebody who's an anxious queen and does not like risky activities, I don't know why I enjoy... I guess when I was little, when I lived in L.A., I would go to Griffith Park and they have horses in Griffith Park that you can like ride and they just walk around and they're definitely like not being treated well. So do not support that in retrospect, but like they walk in a circle or they walk like around a track and you're just like on a horse and it's like fun. And then I went horseback riding in Arizona one time in like the desert and I was like very depressed and then I was on the horse and I was like, beautiful nature. Beautiful nature.
I'm really happy you had that experience. Maybe I'll have a redeeming experience.
We should go go ride horses. Does anybody have a horse?
Any of y'all with generational wealth? Any of you got a horse?
Any of you got a horse? It's crazy. Horses are... So there was also like a cattle auction in Yellowstone and they're expensive.
Yeah.
I don't know how much a cattle was, but one of them was like auctioned for like $100,000. I was like... There's no way a cow can be that expensive, right?
Like, human beings are sold on the black market for less than that.
I just admire people who can just hop on a horse and just go ride. Like,
no, I had a, like, my best friend from elementary school is, like, a huge horse girl, and I went to go visit her in Illinois, and she lives on a farm, and she was like, yeah, I'm just gonna go for a quick ride. I'll be right back, and, like, bareback just hopped on her horse, and they, like, went, and I was like, you are really living it.
Who Bella Hadid owns a horse, I guess. Right. To own a horse. Remember when Kim Kardashian put out the whole thing about like North with her like Persian stallion or whatever, and it was like a $500,000 horse. She bought like 10 of them or something.
Oh my God.
For their Wyoming ranch.
That's crazy. I didn't know that.
Bitches are really going to Wyoming and Montana these days.
Yeah. I have not been to either. They're definitely on my list.
Me neither. Do we have fans in Montana and Wyoming? Can we go on tour?
Yeah. We'll just like rent a little cabin and ride horses and take shrooms and then do a little podcast.
Did I tell you though how I was reading about the Donner Party? I didn't talk about it. Did I talk about that in the last episode?
No, I don't think so.
Well, so basically Yellow Jackets, you learn this in the first episode, so it's not a spoiler, like they go cannibal vibes,
right?
Like at a certain point, that's just how it goes. And I was reading about the Donner Party because they're like the most famous cannibals, like this group that was going westward, like westward expansion, and then they got stuck in salt in like the Great Salt Lake Desert or whatever.
Yeah,
basically some dude was like, I made a new trail, you guys should go on my trail, and they were like, okay. And then it turned out his trail was a flop trail and he'd never actually like really been on it, but he told people to go on it, and it got them stuck in like the Sierra Nevada like snowy mountains, I think. And then they like had to start eating each other. It was like not good.
Not vibes.
But like, it was crazy.
Yeah.
Because in other situations, like in the Andes plane crash with the soccer players, like at least from what they've told us, they didn't try to kill people to eat them.
Right.
It was just like somebody would die and then they would eat them. But in this one, they were like, we're literally just like stabbing people and eating them. And like half the people on the Donner
Comes down to it. I mean,
half the people on the Donner Party died.
Wow.
Because I've been watching 1883, I've been reading about like kind of that era and like the the stereotype is always like, oh, Native Americans and like whatever the pioneers like had like altercations and they killed the pioneer. And it's like, that was actually like way down on the list of what would kill you on the Oregon Trail. Yeah. Number one was like cholera. falling off the wagon is number one.
Wait, that's so funny that that's like a phrase that we use now. Like, oh yeah, she really fell off the wagon. Like,
literally just falling off the wagon. Number two is cholera, because bitches were drinking standing water when they should have been boiling it. And number three were bandits, which was a real thing.
Really?
Yeah, there were like bandits that were like other like white people that were basically on the trails. Like,
scammers have always existed, you guys.
Yeah.
Should we get into our topic?
Yeah. Speaking of land.
Yeah. Speaking of land, we're gonna talk about gentrification today
and housing
and housing and redlining and Facebook
and generational wealth.
Yeah.
Speaking though of land in Yellowstone, the Duttons, the family, they own a ranch in Montana that's the size of Rhode Island.
Jesus.
Like, that's
Christ.
How much land they own, simply because they just like got there in 1883, I guess, and like forced natives off their land, and like, so they have that much land. But a lot of what we're going to be talking about today is like how people own land and own homes and stuff like that, and like how it gets passed on through generations. And obviously, like, if you have that much land and you pass it down and there aren't laws that like force you to give up any of your land,
right,
then the great people American, make a lot of money.
The great American tradition of stealing land and pushing people off land and moving in and building fucking
and thinking
targets.
That you can when I was watching it too yesterday, I was watching them go down this river, and there were like these other people that were in the river, and I was like, do they own that river? And then I was like, that's so fucked up that people can just like own a river.
Yeah,
like, you don't own that river.
Yeah, yeah, this land is your land, this land is my land.
They really did not stick to that.
Yeah.
Okay, should we read some of our mailbox moments?
Yeah, let's read our mailbox
moments. We have
moments.
Topical mailbox moments. We asked you guys to tell us about your experiences with gentrification. And something that Eliza and I were talking about that we really love is that we don't have a ton of guests on our podcast. We do guests on our bonus episodes, mainly because you guys just don't like when we have guests most of the time. But you guys are our guests. Like, when we ask for mailbox moments, it's because we genuinely want to hear from people who have the experiences that we're talking about, and we really value you guys contributing, and you guys are basically our guests on the podcast when we want to talk about something that we don't have that much personal experience with.
Yeah, and you provide such important contributions, because like, we really do care and we really do research, but as always, like, again, we are two white cis women, our scope is very limited, and like, we really appreciate, I mean, some of the vulnerability that it takes some of you to write in is like really admirable, and we really appreciate you being willing to share your stories, and we're really happy that we're able to like refer to them.
And how cool is it to have your actual listeners be your guests?
Yes.
Okay, so the first one that we're reading is called Denver Yuppies. Hi ladies, let me get straight to it. I live in Denver, Colorado, probably one of the whitest states ever, but I am Latina, so all I have known is the predominantly Latino/Black community I have lived in since I was born. I know it as the East Side, but everyone else knows it as the Reno District. My grandma grew up here, my mom did, I did, and now my daughter is. Oh my God, love that you have a daughter.
Aww.
Love when we have mom listeners.
Yes, hi moms.
Growing up, it was full of gang violence, drugs, teen pregnancy, etc. The literal epitome of white saviors consider, quote, the ghetto. To me, this was home, although all of the things that came with it wasn't ideal. We were a community, the kind where all the kids knew each other, all the parents looked out for each other, and where everyone called each other's grandparents, grandmen, grandpa too. At the end of the day, we survived and took care of each other the way we knew how. Starting in about 2012, those silly little contemporary blockhouses started popping up. Y'all know the ones I'm talking about. You know, the kind that stick out like sore thumbs. Soon, the local convenience stores and restaurants were closing. Then we started seeing less kids and more dogs and even more cops. It really hit me when my little brother almost got arrested for hanging out outside of the school with his friends because they were, quote, intimidating the white folk that lived across from the school. Families that lived in this area for generations moved because it was getting more expensive and more obvious that we weren't welcome here anymore. Now houses are up to $500,000 for a two-bedroom with a tiny yard. Cops are around more than ever, and so many businesses that were run by minority families became yoga centers and expensive coffee shops. It's crazy how universal this experience is for so many lower-class or minority communities. It's even crazier to me that the people that have moved here look at us like we're out of place. That's just how the capitalist cookie crumbles, I guess. Love you both and love the pod. Ayana.
Thank you, Ayana. We're just going to sort of do a few more just so we have time and not talk in between all of them.
Yeah, we'll be
share.
Talking about all of it afterwards.
Yeah, this whole podcast is us talking. Now it's time for you guys to say your
talk.
Yeah. Okay, this email is called Gentrification Kicked My Family Out of New York. My dearest Julia and Williza. It's funny. She made a typo and corrected it in the follow-up.
Williza.
Honestly, changing my name. Hi, Hopi Queens are well. I've been binge listening to the pod for about a month now, and I'm finally caught up. I've spent countless hours forcing my boy Fee to listen to episodes with me, and it has exponentially enlightened our silly little brains. We love you. Anyways, I've got a little story about my town. So I live on Long Island, and if you didn't know, that shit is segregated as fuck, especially in terms of education. There are school districts that pay their teachers $100,000 and have all these advanced extracurriculars and the funding to support all sorts of recreational activity. Then there was my school district that gave students textbooks that were literally about to disintegrate by just one touch. I'm in my third year of college studying to be an ELL teacher in hopes to support students that come from these poorer school districts and their influx of mostly Hispanic students, but it's definitely affected me and my family's life. I'm a Latina, and every single family member I have is an immigrant from my home country, El Salvador, so already we were at a disadvantage in America. Me and my closest relatives grew up living in a town where the majority of people inhabiting it were Hispanic and Black. I grew up all squished together in one home with my family, sharing beds with my cousins and eating dinner on the floor. The only people working were my uncles and dad, who all made money working in kitchens without any sort of benefits. The Long Island prices kept going up, and slowly different big corporations were making their way in our town. At first, it was really cool. I've never had Starbucks or shopped at a Target. This was going to be awesome. However, the bodegas my uncles worked in and the hair salon my tia began her training in was sold to these companies that essentially tore them down to build a new Chick-fil-A. It kind of sucked. Long story short, all my cousins, tias and tios, moved to Texas, where they pretty much live life in complete boredom because there they were able to find cheap apartments and jobs in either the kitchen, cleaning, or agricultural labor. Me and my family, on the other hand, managed to stay in New York because my dad's boss bribed him with a raise, lol. I don't know if this story answers you guys' questions or gives you any sort of view into how that's affected my life, but losing pretty much all of my family was really damaging for my parents and even me because we really value the close celebrations that we would have together and the community that we all had. Every family gathering was special. My fellow Latinx besties know how close-knit so many family dynamics are in our culture, so it's been awfully lonely since their move. Then she says a lot of really sweet stuff about the podcast, so thank you. Love you guys, Mariella.
This one is called Gentrification Mailbox. Dearest Binchellas, love. I am writing to you from rainy, rapidly gentrifying Ridgewood, Queens in New York City. When I saw your story requesting stories of experiences with gentrification, I thought, this is my moment. I was born and raised in New York City, the daughter of a single mother who worked in early childhood education. No money. When I was 9, the building I had lived in my entire life was sold, and my mom couldn't afford any other apartments in the neighborhood, and made the decision to move us to Queens. The experience of being displaced by gentrification was deeply humiliating and angering. I remember potential buyers coming into our apartment with their shoes on, rude, and turning on and off our faucets to check the water pressure. Even as a fourth grader, the injustice of having to uproot your entire life and move to a different place was not lost on me. It wasn't a huge geographic distance, but in New York City, even moving a couple miles away can be a drastic shift in culture and local politics. Since moving 13 years ago, I have come to really identify with my neighborhood and build strong relationships here. I have also gotten involved with the tenant organizing, which is incredibly empowering. The part of the city I live in is very diverse. The most languages are spoken in Queens of any municipality in the country, but it is also overrun by the interests of real estate developers, the business improvement district, politicians, and the community board members who are part of the very racist, classist old guard of the neighborhood. Ridgewood has a long history of being a Nazi stronghold. Several people were arrested in connection with January 6th, and apparently during World War II, people painted swastikas on their roof just in case Germany tried to bomb New York, which does not make me nervous at all as an Ashkenazi Jew. Hi, Julia. Hey. The class and race struggles in Ridgewood are not new at all and are very much still alive today. We also have a long history of socialist organizing in the interest of working people. There is some degree of animosity between New York City natives and transplants. I look like a hipster gentrifier, white, queer, BFA, early 20s, but I've lived here my entire life and have experienced gentrification firsthand. I think because of my personal experiences and because of the collective work I am engaged in, I have come to see gentrification less as an issue of individual young urban creatives coming and displacing largely working-class immigrant families, but more as big real estate making neighborhoods unlivable for anyone without generational wealth and steady income streams. Neighborhoods should be for immigrants, queers, poor people, artists, workers, everyone. And I think it's intentional that the blame is put on individuals instead of property managers who buy up buildings and triple the rent. People have to live somewhere, preferably near jobs, friends, family, schools, parks, transportation, etc. To fight gentrification, we have to stop fighting each other and build solidarity with our neighbors, who are more or less in the same economic boat, i.e. closer to homelessness than billionairehood. I encourage you both to check out LA Tenants Union if you have not already. They are doing amazing work, and I know Eliza has landlord/apartment issues. Much love, Issa. Pronounced how Issa Rae pronounces her first name, but with one S. P.S. In your episode, Girl Bossing Too Close to the Sun, you referenced an article by Stella Rose St. Clair and said that you thought that wasn't a real name. I would like to inform you that I am her second cousin and that is her real name somehow.
Our apologies to Stella Rose St. Clair.
Shout out to Stella and Issa.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. I also think that you're right about, you know, placing the blame on individual people. That seems like a thing that we do in our society, which obviously individual people are at fault, but larger corporations and laws and things are behind why people are able to do that in the first place.
Yeah, of course. Like, it's not that we don't have any individual responsibility, but there are people who engineer these things to happen and basically engineer certain people to move into places. It doesn't mean that those people shouldn't be cognizant of it or that they shouldn't go elsewhere if that is an opportunity available to them. But we just wanted to get into today, really, how gentrification happens, what it is, who plans it out and executes it, and what the effects have been.
Yeah, it's a massive topic, and we have many, many sources. So if you guys want to take notes on our sources, if you want to look at them yourselves, you're welcome to.
I mean, really buckle up, because we've done a lot for this one.
Buckle up. We're already 47 minutes into this episode.
Yeah, you might be treated to a long one today.
Okay. We can't really talk about gentrification without talking about redlining, which is a really important historical phenomenon and something that still occurs today. And I got my information from NPR, A Forgotten History of How the U.S. Government Segregated America, another article called What is Redlining from the New York Times, and a third article called How Redlining's Racist Effects Lasted for Decades. Okay, so in 1933... during the Great Depression, there was a housing shortage in America, and the federal government created a program that was specifically intended to increase and segregate American housing. So increase more housing for white people and segregate housing in general.
Right.
This was basically state-sponsored segregation. And so the government wanted to create new housing with government-insured mortgages for white middle-class and lower-middle-class families, while Black Americans and other people of color were excluded and pushed into urban housing projects. And so the government insured mortgages is like, you can't get a house like without a mortgage and loans and things like that. And basically white people have always been like offered those things way more than Black people and people of color.
Yeah, general. I even saw a tweet literally yesterday of this Black woman. And she was like, I've been trying to come see this apartment for like a week at this point. They haven't been returning my calls. I had a white friend call to ask and see, and they got back to her within the day. So like, these are not old things, like they're still happening today.
Yeah, it still totally is lasting. And so the government, in order to create this plan, created a system for color coding neighborhoods and ranking them from least risky to most risky from A to D. And risky means basically, are there people of color there?
Right.
And also, but like the implication was like, it's risky to invest here because this isn't like a growing like good neighborhood.
Sure.
So it was for like investors, I guess, and like people in general to just know like, here are the neighborhoods where white people are and they're an up and coming neighborhood, and here are the neighborhoods where Black people are and don't invest in those neighborhoods and don't give people loans.
Right.
So D areas were places marked in red where property values were likely to go down and were therefore not worth including in home ownership and lending programs. Obviously, these red areas were primarily areas where Black Americans lived. And as a result, Black homeowners couldn't get home loans from federal insurance programs, which creates a self-fulfilling prophecy where these areas are redlined because they've already been deemed as unworthy. Then they deteriorate further, which increases white flight, which is white people leaving areas where Black people are moving into because they're like, oh, it's dangerous and it's not a good area and we're going to move to the suburbs.
Yeah, and like the property value is going to go down.
Yeah, and segregation. And so the availability of credit really affects neighborhoods. It affects real estate, investors that might come in, the prices of property. And if people don't have credit and they don't have access to home loans, then there are slumlords and predatory lenders and population instability. And people will basically like scam poor people out of like a home that could be a house for one family, but they split it into a bunch of different like units and there's slumlords that are running them and there's no opportunity for mobility.
Yeah. And just another note on how fucking predatory like lending companies can be is that I failed to pay one of my monthly payments for Gold's Gym and then ignored their calls and it got put into collections eventually. And how I knew that it got put into collections is because I started getting a bunch of fucking emails that were like, free $2,000, claim now, or like Section 8 housing available, like click this to whatever. And it was insane the amount of companies and places invested in just like swindling poor people out of every dime.
Yeah, they were like, you seem like you can't pay your bills. Yeah. How about we scam you even further?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's horrible. And so Black residents can't move elsewhere because of discriminatory housing practices. These neighborhoods are already segregated and there's basically nowhere else to go except for other areas where there are no opportunities and no like options for mobility.
Right.
And the existing homeowners, if you're lucky enough to own a home, get no government money for renovation and repairs. And so these neighborhoods further deteriorate. And then white people basically blame members of these communities for not valuing their homes and not keeping up their neighborhoods. And like, oh, look how gross this park is. Look how gross these houses are, when they're actually just not getting any money from the government that white neighborhoods are getting to make their parks nice and make their schools nice and make their houses nice.
Yeah, like public schools are funded by property taxes.
Yeah.
And so if you're in a neighborhood where people refuse to repair your home and where your homes are being devalued, then naturally your schools do not get as much funding. Like, that's why some public schools are better than other public schools.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that later when we talk about Proposition 13. But your grandmother, right, lives in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Does she own her house?
I'm pretty sure she does, yes.
And when you own a house, like, that creates generational wealth. And this was something that I didn't know until I was reading about it, that like, really, home ownership is what creates generational wealth. Because even if you don't have a lot of money or you don't have a really high paying job, your grandmother can leave that house to your dad, which then has higher, that, you know, it's increased in property values. And then your dad can pass that house on to you. And like, that's how money accrues in a family. Because if you're able to own a home, that home will increase value and you will get that money eventually.
No, I remember it's a big thing because my grandparents, my dad's parents, were the first people in our entire family on my dad's side to ever own a home. And so it was like a huge thing when they own their home.
Right. And that's a huge thing to be able to do, because when you own a home, you give your children and your grandchildren future wealth, basically.
Yeah.
And over the last century, despite civil rights, despite, you know, all these things changing, allegedly, the Black-white gap in home ownership has changed very little. So today, Black incomes on average are about 60% of average white incomes, but Black wealth is about 5% of white wealth.
Wow.
And so a lot of this is not about, like, generational wealth is not about necessarily like how much are you making in your salary, but like, do you have assets that have been passed down in your family?
Right.
Like, if you've owned a house, then that's a huge asset that you have that is able to create generational wealth. And most middle-class American families gain wealth from home equity, which is the value of the homes that you own. Mm-hmm. So if you're not allowed to own a house or you don't have a loan for a house, there's no way to really do that. And this is basically almost entirely the fault of the federal housing policy in the 20th century. Then in 1968, the Fair Housing Act was passed that basically said Black people are free to buy homes wherever they want. But this is an empty promise, because the homes in neighborhoods that might have been accessible in the past are no longer affordable because white people were able to go buy homes in those suburbs decades ago.
Right, when they actually were affordable.
So when in 1968, they're like, what? You can buy a house wherever you want. Like, that's an empty promise because you don't have the generational wealth to buy a house or the accessibility to neighborhoods that were once developing that white people have had in their families for generations.
Right, and now the prices of the houses in those neighborhoods is just like totally skyrocketed.
Right. So now we're going to get into gentrification, which is another aspect of kind of the housing crisis that we're currently experiencing. And I read this article from the National Community Reinvestment Coalition website called Shifting Neighborhoods, Gentrification and Cultural Displacement in American Cities. And another one from the New York Review of Books about Ruth Glass, who is the sociologist who coined the term gentrification. And we're going to talk a little bit about her. So British sociologist Ruth Glass coined the term gentrification in 1964. Ruth Glass was a German Jew who fled Nazi Germany for Britain in the 1930s. She was a committed Marxista and a pioneer in her field.
Love.
And she used the term gentrification to describe the displacement of working class London residents by middle class newcomers. So it wasn't necessarily racial at that point, mm-hmm. but the like gentry is what means people of good social position. Think like landed gentry, if you've ever heard that term.
Right.
And it's specifically a British thing, like that there are landed gentry, like fancy people who own land and then people who don't own land. So gentrification is like the fancification, basically, of people who own land coming in and taking over a neighborhood.
Yeah.
In 1958, there were Notting Hill riots between white and Afro-Caribbean residents that culminated in horrific anti-Black violence. And Ruth Glass was, you know, observing this, white people claimed that the problem was that non-white immigrants are infiltrating our cities, when Ruth Glass wrote that the actual problem was that there's persistent discrimination against non-white Britons in terms of work and housing. So it's not that like tons of non-white people are coming into your city, it's that there are not places for them to live that are affordable and not jobs that are, you know, paying high enough wages.
Right.
And so this is a quote from her. She wrote, "Once this process of gentrification starts in a district, it goes on until all or most of the original working class occupiers are displaced and the whole social character of the district is changed." So gentrification has always been understood as a kind of neighborhood change in which poor residents who are incumbent residents, meaning they've lived somewhere for years, are displaced by wealthier people who then subsequently raise the property value. And in the U.S., gentrification usually occurs along racial lines because of this redlining that we talked about, which doesn't mean it's not like in racial lines in other places as well. But specifically in America, gentrification has a lot of like racial implications.
Because we literally mapped out black and white neighborhoods.
Yeah. And it's interesting because some people have different responses to gentrification. There are some impoverished residents who are like, when are we going to get gentrification? Because that means that we get more resources and we get government like funding and things like that. But then it also displaces people and it weakens family, like community and family ties. So like, yeah, the idea of like making a neighborhood nicer is really nice, but not if the people who live there are then displaced and can't even benefit from the gentrification.
Right, exactly. Like the things that most quickly gentrify a neighborhood is like access to public transport, access to good grocery stores, good hospitals, schools, you know, community
fancy coffee stores,
places to hang out, which are like in any ideal society, you know, we would have that. Like, yeah, those are really great markers of a great neighborhood, but those should be available to the people that already live there.
You should be doing that and not raising the property value.
Yeah, and the reason why that's valuable is because it's so scarce. Like, good public transport access is very scarce in America.
Yeah.
If you're not in, like, New York or something.
Yeah. And so on an aesthetic level, gentrification is like, oh, new houses, new shinier businesses. Mm-hmm. There's a yoga studio. There's a Starbucks. There's a Whole Foods. And, like, people might see that and be like, wow, this neighborhood is so much nicer than it used to be. Like, good job.
Right.
But what's actually happening is that local governments are making policy decisions that affect zoning laws, allocation of resources, and availability of transportation. And then private developers are like, this is now getting more government resources. This seems like it's a desirable neighborhood where we can really increase property values and, you know, get a lot of money from white people who want to move here. And so obviously this is an economic phenomenon, but it also is a racial and cultural shift because these minority neighborhoods that are seen as cool and edgy are no longer affordable to the incumbent residents. But white people are like, oh, that seems, you know, Brooklyn at first was like not, I mean, that's where all like the immigrants were in Ellis Island. They all went to Brooklyn. There were like tenement houses there.
Yeah.
And then as, you know, people start getting New York City gets fancier and fancier. And like, you know, the area in like where the West Village is gets gentrified. Then people are like pushed further. Now they're like, okay, now time to gentrify Brooklyn. And then it's like unrecognizable to the people who once lived there.
Totally.
There's kind of a question of like, does gentrification have to mean displacement? And in general, studies have found that low-income people have to move more often, regardless of if they're in a gentrified area or not. But with gentrification, the neighborhood experiences a net loss of low-income residents because housing costs rise and the neighborhood becomes less and less affordable. And then affluent white people moving into these lower-income areas results in racial exclusion because Black and Hispanic people are still denied loans and credit way more than white people are, which is the continuation of redlining.
Totally.
So it doesn't mean that like displacement doesn't occur when places aren't gentrifying, but gentrification really amplifies that process and makes it happen way more quickly. And also then all of a sudden incumbent residents are denied loans for areas that they grew up in and white people are getting those loans.
Yeah. And in fact, displacement is a necessity of gentrification. It like can't fully succeed as a project without displacing people.
Well, because the whole idea is like, well, different people are moving into the neighborhood. And that's why we're making it nicer, not because we just generally want to make this neighborhood nicer.
It's nothing in our capitalist economy is done to just genuinely improve the health and wellness of the population.
Yeah.
Yeah. So gentrification as a process, you necessarily have to displace residents that were already there. And when we say displace, like in my mind, when I first think about it, it's like, oh, it really sucks. Like people have to pick up and move and like leave their families, leave their communities. Right. But what displacement often means is evictions and, you know, rates of homelessness. And in preparation for this episode, I read Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City by Matthew Desmond. And it's a really great book. It like won the Pulitzer, I think. Mm-hmm. And he, so Desmond is a Princeton sociologist, and he followed 8 families in Milwaukee struggling to maintain housing. And basically the point of him writing it was to talk about how housing is so integral to poverty and how it's kind of like the one thing that up until that point, like we haven't really acknowledged how integral it is to poverty. Not having a home is the number one thing that Absolutely. That puts you into poverty, or not having that type of access. And like you were talking about with generational wealth, like, you know, housing has always been so intricately connected with that. So yeah, his book is about evictions and about, you know, the pipeline of evicted to homeless and how even, quote, like good landlords who want to try to rent to single family poor homes or to single parents, like they can't really make ends meet by doing that. So it's uh-huh. kind of about that whole system. He talks about the history of evictions, which I'm just going to briefly summarize. But what I didn't know is that evictions used to be very rare, like so much so that they would draw crowds when they happened. Like if one family, like there's a story of one family getting evicted in like the 30s, and a newspaper wrote like only a crowd of 2,000 showed up, perhaps because of the cold. Like
only 2,000.
I know. And that was for one family getting evicted. Like during the Depression, eviction riots were really, really frequent. Like anytime somebody would get evicted, the whole community would show up and riot about it. And of course, evictions then were a fucking fraction of what evictions are today, especially during COVID, all the stuff we've been hearing a ton about evictions.
I mean, it's really interesting that the Great Depression created kind of all of these new zoning laws and all of these like changes in the housing market, because all of a sudden white people were really poor.
Right.
And that was a major
that
issue.
That was intolerable for the government.
Yeah.
And today there are sheriff squads whose full-time job is to carry out eviction and foreclosure orders. Like it's somebody's entire job, like thousands of people across the country. And another fucked up part of the whole evictions process is that like data mining companies will sell landlords the screening reports of tenants, which show them like the past evictions and the court filings. Like this is another way that people of color get cut out of housing, because you can be evicted for being $10 short on your rent, then you have an eviction on your screening report, and then other people won't rent to you. Like it just like boxes you out of a lot of shit.
Yeah.
And housing factors into poverty in a major way, because there are so many people spending the majority of their income on housing. I guess that's what I meant and what Desmond means when he says that like we don't investigate how much housing contributes to poverty just because of the cost.
Right.
Like the majority of poor renting families in America spend over half their income on housing, and at least 1 in 4 dedicate over 70% just to rent. And like as a reference, most financial guides that you'll ever read recommend spending 30% or less of your income on rent.
Yeah. And if you're not even like renting to buy the house, then basically all that money is going out the window, because it's not creating any future wealth for your family.
Totally. And especially if people are on welfare or disability, housing is almost impossible to afford. Like people have these, especially Republicans have these narratives of like welfare queens, and people are just like, you know, draining the government of all of our resources. But fucking like in Milwaukee, if you are disabled and you cannot work because of a physical disability, your monthly stipend is $628. And the average rent is around $550. So that would leave you just over $2 a day for everything, which, in, you know, like utilities, car insurance, health insurance, groceries. Like people really have this idea that the people on government assistance are like draining the country's resources. Another aspect of government welfare is that some people get housing vouchers from the government. And this basically means that they pay a small percentage of the rent and then their taxpayers pay the rest. So like maybe the tenant pays 30% and then the rest of it taxpayers cover. So then the Department of Housing and Urban Development in whatever city the housing vouchers are in sets what's called the FMR, which is the fair market rate. So basically that rate is the maximum amount that a landlord could charge a family who has a federal housing voucher. And the value is determined by like a pretty wide radius, like that max amount. So like, for example, New York City's FMR calculation includes like Soho, but also the South Bronx, where like the housing markets are very different. But usually like families aren't moving to Soho, even if they can afford it there. Usually families are looking to stay in their, you know, communities.
Yeah.
And they'll get charged more for their rent because maybe the housing voucher covers $1,200 a month and the average cost in that area is $600 a month. The landlord knows they can pay up to $1,200, so they'll charge the tenant $1,000, even if the property is actually valued lower.
You've seen Maid, right?
Yeah.
You know that whole scene where she's like, she has the federal housing like voucher and nobody will take it because they don't want to have to deal with it.
Yeah.
So it's like they, like all the apartments that she goes to, when she's like, well, I'll be paying in the voucher, they're like, nope, get out of my house.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, is the landlords know that they can hike up the price too, even if somebody does have the voucher. And this is the thing that costs taxpayers. Like when people talk about like their hard-earned money being taken away by welfare programs, like in a way it is, but only because the welfare programs are being abused. And actually, like a crazy statistic is overcharging voucher holders for housing cost taxpayers an additional $3.6 million each year in Milwaukee alone.
And that's just like the landlords that are being assholes.
Yeah, that's landlords hiking up the price because they know the housing voucher can pay for it, and that comes out of taxpayers.
And that's not the individual person on welfare's fault at all.
No, not at all. Not at all. That's a landlord trying to make money. So we're seeing that charging for housing is like a huge cornerstone of a capitalist economy. And there's so much money to be made in the business, you know, from landlords to developers to utility companies. And, you know, with the fair market rate shit, like even programs that subsidize housing get their benefits like twisted to make somebody money, because we've built a society off of a profit incentive versus, you know, anything else.
Right.
And yeah, just, you know, really stressing that that displacing residents is not simply forcing people to move. It's forcing people into homelessness, and it's forcing people into poverty, and it's not allowing them to move other places. It's like a really, it's not just inconvenient. It's in, and even in like situations like that one listener who wrote us in and was like, I'm displaced from my entire family. And that's really terrifying. Like, yes. And sometimes people are like pushed even to homelessness. So it's a much bigger thing than we usually think about.
Another statistic that I think about a lot when I think about homelessness that I heard from You're Wrong About is that like most people are temporarily homeless.
Yeah.
It's not like there's these people that like, you know, when people think like, oh, homeless people are draining the resources. Like there's like 10% of people that are chronically homeless. Like the other 90% of people are temporarily homeless because they've been evicted or because they can't afford housing or something like that. It's not like a career for people to like be homeless.
Yeah. And it's like nobody chooses to be homeless, and the people that are chronically homeless are often mentally ill or addicted without the proper support. It's really infuriating. On this topic of evictions and gentrification, I fell into a bit of a rabbit hole, and I don't want to reveal what it is quite yet because there's a sort of narrative to it.
Okay.
But I just want you to imagine a society.
I love when you do an imagine. I want you to imagine a society.
And I do. Sit down, children. I want you to imagine a society like this. You step out your front door to a main street designed by the same contractors who designed Disneyland. Everything is walkable. The barbershop, the coffee shop, restaurants, your workplace. And if you don't feel like walking, there's a free shuttle or even free bikes that you can just take. They're everywhere. And even if you insist on driving, parking is plentiful for just about anywhere you'd like to go. You can get your clothes laundered and dry cleaned for free. There are plenty of places to gather and meet with other community members, from outdoor terraces to grassy expanses. There's a gym you can use for free. Or if you prefer to exercise outside, there's a rooftop park spanning over 12 acres. How does that sound?
Would love to experience that.
Right.
That sounds great.
Well, this society is real because I've just described the Facebook headquarters in Menlo Park, California.
Wow.
So that is the Facebook campus. Included, like, it's crazy that it's literally designed by the people who designed Disneyland.
Is it?
Yeah.
I was thinking like that, you know, that place that's like Celebration, Florida, mm-hmm. that's like designed by Disney. It's like that, except apparently there are a lot of murders in Celebration, which is...
Well, we'll get into the dark side of the Facebook campus too.
How big is the Facebook campus?
The Facebook campus is, I think, like 264 acres.
I don't know how much an acre is.
It's big. Let me see.
Can you give me a comparison?
Yes.
A football field is 1.32 acres in size.
Right.
So if you visualize it as a football field and you said how many acres it is?
250.
So that's basically over like 300 football fields.
Right. Exactly. And so that's how big the existing campus is. And in June of 2021, Facebook discussed plans to expand their campus to include an adjacent village, which would be home to more retail and food businesses, along with many housing developments. So recalling back to A Push, do you recall the idea of a company town?
A company town is a town where people who work at a company all live together.
Yeah, ding, ding, ding. So yeah, it's a company town. Very good. You're getting a five on the exam. So a company town is where all the stores and the housing is owned by one company. And those didn't end up going over too well. Big shocker, people found themselves at the mercy of the corporation, whose profit motive meant that it exerted very unfair control and like hostility to the residents of the town.
Sounds very dystopian.
Right. So Facebook is like, hey, we have this big campus that we're going to build an adjacent village where our employees can go. And then people are like, hey, this kind of sounds like the company towns. And Facebook's like, OMG, no. We're not doing that. We're not doing that at all. We're simply integrating the campus into the neighborhood
so that you can live and work here.
Right. So let's talk about what neighborhood is by the Menlo Park campus. So there, Facebook is proposing that this new neighborhood that would be integrated to the campus would be called Willow Village. And Willow Village will be wedged in between the Menlo Park neighborhood of Belhaven and the city of East Palo Alto. Both of these are heavily Hispanic communities that are among Silicon Valley's poorest. And Facebook says, it's funny, they originally say that 225 of their 1,500 apartments, which is 15%, will be below market rate. So in other words, 15% of their apartments would be affordable housing. And then people were like even more mad than they made it 250.
So you can go live in the dystopian Facebook community instead of your own vibrant cultural community.
Right. And of course, and you know, people, there's this quote from a woman who works in a community advocacy group, are having thoughts and feelings about this. She basically was like, corporations are paying for things that the city or county and state used to pay for. They have a lot of money, more than the city does, and a lot more power. Like, that's what's starting to happen, is that like corporations see that cities are not, you know, providing the infrastructure that they need for their residents. And so corporations step into that role, which is incredibly dangerous because they're extrajudicial. Like, they're not, you know, part of that whole.
There's no way that you live in a Facebook apartment that's not constantly monitoring you.
Yeah, exactly. And so kind of going back to this idea of company towns, like if we look at the history of company towns, there's this one like crazy story that I found, which is that in the 1900s, the Kohler family established a plumbing fixtures factory and then built a town around it. So, you know, houses, dorms, pension plans, etc. It was a company town. But then we're coming all the way back to the Great Depression, as we always do. Economic conditions deteriorated around the time of the Depression, and employees tried to strike because they weren't getting paid. And in response, Kohler armed their deputies with machine guns. So the company town had their own deputies. And in the clash between the striking workers and the armed deputies, more than 40 strikers were shot and 2 were killed.
Wow.
So obviously the idea of companies having a police force at their beck and call is less than ideal. But, you know, we have laws against that. Like, corporations can't just decide to arm people and give them the power to potentially kill with impunity. That would be crazy. Which is why in 2016, Facebook slid into the DMs of the city of Menlo Park to propose funding for a new police unit that would be specifically designed to police their campus. The city agreed. Facebook bought a police force.
That's insane. I mean, don't college campuses technically do that if they have like campus police?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess that's different because it's not a corporation.
And it's not in collaboration with the city. Like, we had.
It's not a collab between Menlo Park X Facebook.
No, exactly. Like, we had GWPD at GW, but that was not in collaboration. That was not a DC. Those are not DC officers. These are City of Menlo Park officers
that work specifically
for Facebook. But of course, you know, Facebook can't just like buy a police force. Like, that would never, you know, our government's not quite that corrupt. And the mayor of Menlo Park was like, this seems like maybe a bad idea, like accepting favors from corporations in exchange for public services. And then Facebook was like, hear you, King. We totally hear you. We're going to give the city of Menlo Park $11 million up front. And then the city was like, deal.
It's giving robber baron. It's giving Gilded Age, if we're going to go back to A-Push.
Right.
It's giving bribery.
Right. But, you know, it's sort of uncouth to just announce publicly that you've just sold a unit of your police to Facebook. So the official narrative is that Facebook generously made a random donation to the city of Menlo Park. Just like, we're feeling generous, $11 million. And, you know, it just so happened, crazy coincidence, that soon after the city created a police force just for them. But it was not in any way a quid pro quo. It was simply a random donation, and they just made a police force.
It's sad because $11 million is not even that much, and it's probably like nothing, like the tiny fraction of what Facebook could spare.
Right.
And because like property taxes, which I'll talk about with Prop 13, because like taxes are not high enough in these places to actually fund the government, they're accepting donations from corporations
and selling them a police force.
Yeah.
And so soon after, and this also means that there will just be more police officers generally around the community. And so soon after this new police presence was announced, longtime residents of Menlo Park began to express concern, obviously. Like, a lot of the community action groups spoke up about the rampant racial profiling that exists both in Menlo Park and the neighboring East Palo Alto. And there were just concerns about, like, even more police, because they were basically like, crime has not increased, so why are we putting more police on the ground? Because over-policing historically leads to racial profiling when there's just a shit ton of cops and they're just kind of twiddling their thumbs. They're like...
And police violence. Yeah,
exactly. And the community has gripes in general with Facebook, especially in the ways that the company has contributed to gentrification. Like, for example, employees of Facebook were offered a $15K bonus for moving within 10 miles of the Facebook campus. So
that's horrifying.
Yeah. And in response to that, the activists in East Palo Alto and Bellhaven basically feared that this would lead to the displacement of residents. Like, oh my God, you're paying people so much money to what, move into our communities? So they asked that Facebook would exclude those communities from the incentive. So basically, you should move within 10 miles of Facebook so that we can give you the money, but you can't move to Bellhaven or to East Palo Alto.
That seems like a very reasonable request.
Yes, which Facebook complied with. But essentially what ends up happening is that Facebook is paying employees to avoid certain areas. So none of the money from Facebook or from the tech industry goes into those cities. Right. And now the Facebook city is heavily policed to essentially keep out the poor. This is what we're talking about, gentrification. It's what happens when the government does not have the resources to fund the social structures that it needs to fund.
And they're redlining these other areas, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So one facet of this, like, glittering, perfect Disney city directly next to, you know, the poor, impoverished communities that do not get any of the resources that Facebook is just, like, continuously creating is, you know, there's some tension happening. And an obvious manifestation of this is this, like, deal with the Facebook bicycles. And this whole situation is honestly just a good example of what the role of the new police force is in terms of Facebook and how much power Facebook ends up having in the Menlo Park community and to the local government. So, you know, as I talked about in my, you know, ideal design of the city, which ends up being the Facebook campus, Facebook gives employees free rein of their bicycles. Like, they have a bunch of bicycles laying around. And the only rule is that the employees are not allowed to take them off of the Facebook campus. Despite this rule, many do, and also many of them simply just, like, ditch the bikes off campus when they're done with them. So they'll ride the Facebook bike, take it off campus, decide they're going to catch a train or whatever, leave the bike somewhere in, like, Menlo Park. So young people in the community are seeing just, like, abandoned bikes, like, clearly someone has ditched the bike, and they start riding them around town, like, to school or to work, etc., and became immediate targets by the police. And on one occasion, a Hispanic man was arrested for riding a Facebook bike off campus, and then they arrested him and detained him on larceny. But it turns out that the man was a Facebook employee. And so then Facebook requested that no criminal charges be levied against him, and all the charges were dropped. So this particular situation was really interesting to me because it shows the really dangerous influence that Facebook has over the state. You have state actors arresting citizens on Facebook's behalf, state actors put particularly there to protect Facebook's property. And then when Facebook says, oh, actually, he works for us, don't charge him, they say, okay. So they're at Facebook's beck and call on both sides because Facebook is funding them.
I mean, I don't want to say that the police isn't already like this because there's definitely always somebody that can be like, drop the charges, right, and they will. But like, it's very like obvious here.
Yeah, it's really, really, really unsettling.
Not the police taking bribes.
As they do every day. But yeah, and you know, as we were talking about like the individual responsibility versus the state's responsibility versus the developer's responsibility. There's actually, we got a really good quote from a listener who works in housing and is on her way to going to grad school for urban development. And she said, I think gentrification is becoming such a buzzword, seeped in individual blame, is so dangerous because it stops us from making actual change that keeps people in their homes. I hope we eventually get to the point where we think about gentrification through a similar lens as we used to think about fast fashion. While we should all be avoiding it as much as possible, those of us with the money can avoid it a lot more easily, while those of us that are poor sometimes have few other options. At this point, most people would not say, oh, you've bought some things from fast fashion, you're individually responsible for slavery and sweatshops. I think this is similar. If you move into a gentrifying neighborhood and you can afford to live somewhere else, are you blame-free? Not quite. Are you the problem? Definitely not.
So it's like kind of with global warming. Like, you know, individual people should be responsible and recycle and things like that. But there are larger forces that are going to keep incentivizing people to act in a certain way. And if you don't act that way, somebody else will, because these larger corporations and larger structures are still influencing people to act like that.
Yeah, exactly. And when a place is in the process of being gentrified, the housing can be on the more affordable side with some of the amenities that are not available in other communities. So this is why people are left with limited options when it comes to moving somewhere. Like, it's not always possible to not move to a gentrified right. or a gentrifying area. Like, I think about this a lot in terms of LA, where we both live, like, where almost every community is gentrified or in the process of being gentrified.
Yeah.
Like, the city is called Los Angeles. And when you think about the classic, you know, the typical Angeleno, you're like, oh, it's a white, wealthy yoga mom. Like, that's the new face of Los Angeles. I live in East Hollywood, which I know is a gentrifying area, and I wanted to look specifically into what that process looks like and how it's affecting the community. Like, for reference, I moved to East Hollywood because it was quite literally the only place in the city where I could afford a studio apartment. As we know, my leasing company is basically a slumlord. Like, I...
Skunks on the property.
Skunks on the property. If you've listened to the Patreon, you know.
People wanted an update, too, on the skunks on the property.
Update is that I haven't seen or heard tell of skunks, so I think they conducted business elsewhere. But what I found out about my leasing company in particular, and if you look them up, they have terrible reviews online. They have a really big reputation of renting to addicts and mentally ill people, aka people that they can kind of swindle out of money. Like,
you're like, and I am a little mentally ill, so I guess I
so I was preyed upon. But you know, then there is a chapter in this book called Evicted, where this landlord literally walks up to people who he knows, like, are drug addicts, and goes, where's my money? Where's my money? Where's my money? You owe me $600. You owe me $600. And they just give it to them because they're, you know, they're kind of not in their right mind. Like, they're just easier to manipulate. Yeah, so I live in a building with a bunch of other artists scraping by and a few single family homes crowded into one bedrooms. It's also, like, really unfair that it's just, like, you know, 20-year-old... I go to bed at 10 p.m. I have quite the bedtime. But there are people, like, partying on the weekends. And right. I know my neighbor is a single mom with her 8-year-old kid. It's just, like, really unfortunate. And, you know, like I said, East Hollywood is absolutely a gentrifying place, like, currently. And, you know, I'm in the tough situation of I actually can't afford to live anywhere else.
Yeah.
So an article I found from LA Taco, actually, talks about the effects of, you know, people like me moving into the neighborhood. And this really got me thinking about how white people moving into historical neighborhoods of color affects the community more than just what has to do with money. Like, when I moved, I was making around the median income for my neighborhood. I wasn't, like, a wealthier person moving in.
Right.
But, you know, I bought my groceries at Ralph's and at Vaughn's, and so did a lot of other white people who moved into the neighborhood. And this article talks about how mom and pop stores that have been owned and operated by community members for ages are going out of business. Like, around my neighborhood, there's a bunch of ethnic grocery stores. There's a bunch of, like, local and family-owned right. stores.
I know you talked about the Thai grocery store.
Exactly. Yeah. That when I moved in, you know, I noticed I just naturally didn't gravitate towards these places. There's also, you know, on the, like, really close to my house is, like, a huge fucking Target. And then a few blocks to the left of that is a Food for Less that has been shut down, which is one of, like, the only affordable grocery stores.
Right.
And I have some things about how I've been thinking about how to be a more involved and connected and responsible community member. But I know that you have other things about the history of LA and about Prop 13.
Yeah. Do you want me to talk about that?
Yeah.
Okay, so I was just doing research on California because I was talking to my aunt this morning about this, and she grew up in Los Angeles, and she was telling me about Prop 13, which completely fucked the housing market. And I had heard of Prop 13 because recently there was, like, a vote on it where they basically kept it.
Uh-huh.
But in general, California, I read this article by Paul Krugman from the New York Times called The Gentrification of Blue America. And he's basically talking about California in this article and saying that if a state has a ton of successful exports, i.e. the tech business, Hollywood, or, you know, in New York, if it's, like, banking or something like that, it should grow everywhere. There should be people coming in that are both wealthier and lower income.
Mm.
But in California, while highly educated workers are moving in to, you know, serve the tech boom, less educated workers are moving out. And it's specifically because of housing. And so California is very much a NIMBY state, which I don't know if you know what NIMBY is.
No, what is that?
So NIMBY, it means not in my backyard. Mm. And there's an ideology called called NIMBYism, where like a lot of people believe in this, where it's basically like, we don't want any projects built in our neighborhood. We don't want housing developments, infrastructure, homeless shelters, chemical plants, prisons, like anything that could like be thought of as like undesirable. We don't, not in my backyard. Right. I don't want it in my neighborhood. So then obviously chemical plants get put in low income communities, which you saw recently in New York. There was some chemical plant that was like exploding.
Oh, yeah.
And there's housing projects all around it because they put it in neighborhoods where there aren't rich white people.
Yeah.
And so Krugman was saying California is very much a NIMBY state, maybe even a banana state. Build absolutely nothing anywhere near anyone.
Oh my God.
Which I don't know if that's a term, but
they're really going crazy with these acronyms.
Right. But California won't add affordable housing, no matter the demand. And the tech boom is increasing housing prices. I mean, specifically, San Francisco used to be in the 60s, you know, a place for artists and like, you know, cool, like edgy people. And now all those areas are completely unaffordable because tech has brought in so many richer, wealthier, educated people and pushed poor people out because there is no housing available for lower income people.
Right.
And so that's obviously resulting in homelessness, which is why California has some of the worst homelessness in the country. Krugman, his thesis is basically that California as a whole is suffering from gentrification. And this quote from him is, there are now in effect two Americas, the America of high tech, high income enclaves that are unaffordable for the less affluent and the rest of the country. And so California's legislature just passed a bill that would basically force suburbs to accept some two-unit buildings alongside single-family homes. Mm-hmm. What he kind of talks about is like, look, obviously New York has massive problems, but like because there are like skyscrapers, many people can live in those places.
Right.
California, with its banana, build like nothing near anywhere, anyone and anyone else. Like there's just tons of areas where it's just single-family homes.
Right.
And there's no like larger structures. Only in downtown LA, which is notoriously or historically has been lower income, are there buildings that can house lots of people.
And one facet of gentrification is building new huge apartment buildings that are all studios and one bedrooms, which is not conducive for families to live in.
Right. And so they passed a bill recently that will force suburbs to accept some two-unit buildings alongside family homes. And this modest measure would make it possible to add around 700,000 housing units, which is basically the same number that was added in the whole state between 2010 and 2019.
That's insane.
So I guess some progress is being made, but something else that is still in effect, which really affects California's housing market, is Proposition 13. And Proposition 13 is an amendment to the California Constitution that was passed in 1978 and really fucked the housing market. And basically, it was a populist backlash to soaring property values. If you know about populism, it's like the government shouldn't interfere with anything. And like, we don't want to have to pay high taxes and we're the people of the land, etc. So I didn't know about this until my aunt was explaining it to me. But basically, if you own a house in California, like, and it gets passed out down through generations, if the house is not being sold, the property tax values are not reassessed, which means that you are still paying 1978 taxes on a house. So if you own a house and, you know, your family bought the house in 1950 and it keeps getting passed down, you're still paying 1978 taxes. Not only that, but it's commercial properties as well, which means that businesses can still be paying 1978 taxes. If a like Bloomingdale's has existed somewhere since 1978, they're still paying 1978 taxes.
What the fuck?
So basically, the amendment says neither commercial nor residential property is reassessed until it's sold. Then it's taxed at 1% of market value, and that can't be increased by more than 2% a year. So even if it is sold, and it's sold like, you know, a ton of years afterwards, it still can only be increased really gradually. They can't be like, okay, now you're paying 22 market prices. And so this proposition decreased property taxes and restricted annual increases of values to an inflation factor. And so basically they can't change this unless there's a change of ownership or a completion of new construction. And these apply equally to all real estate, residential and commercial, whether owned by individuals or corporations.
Wow.
And that's been in state like since 1978. And I guess it's actually 1976 value. That's actually what people are paying.
Wow. So what's the effect of that? Is it just things get passed down generally generationally and people are not having to pay the taxes on them.
Right. And if somebody else, if somebody is, you know, getting a house passed down to them and they're paying 1976 taxes on it, if somebody else is buying a new house and they don't have that like passed down to them and their family, then they're paying 2022 taxes, which means that, first of all, people hold on to vacant land a ton, which means there are all these undeveloped lots all over, you know, Northern and Southern California, because, you know, there's no incentivization for people to sell it. If you're still paying 1976 property taxes, why not just hold on to the land and not develop it? And if the property taxes would go up, then people would maybe move and sell the houses and, like, you know, but it's also just ridiculous because, forget individuals. If you are a business and you're paying 1976 taxes, like, this is specifically why people have blamed Proposition 13 for, like, terrible public schools, because in rich neighborhoods, like, California specifically has horrible, horrible public schools, at least in Los Angeles. You know, my family's lived in Los Angeles for a very long time. And since my grandma, like, was growing up in, like, the 50s, the public schools have, I mean, she went to public school, but they've always kind of been bad. And like, when my mom and her sisters were growing up here, which was in the 70s, they got even worse because of something like Prop 13. If people in Beverly Hills were paying higher property taxes, then that would probably go to schools and make the schools around them better.
Right.
But if they're paying low property taxes and they're sending their kids to private school, then it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
And there's no incentive to, like, give more money to the government.
Wow.
And I guess that recently they put Prop 13 up for, you know, reassessment, and everybody was like, nope, we love Prop 13. I mean, it makes sense. If you own a home, why do you want to pay higher property taxes on it? But it's ridiculous that it's also commercial businesses. And there are all these ways that, like, people get around it. And my aunt was explaining to me that, like, country clubs, for example, new people come in every year that are, like, all part of the ownership of the country club. And so even though the ownership is technically changing, they are still paying the same property taxes because they still technically have the same ownership, which means that these massive country clubs that own all this land in LA are still paying 1976 property taxes, even though their ownership has changed.
That's fucking crazy. I wonder how many other states have something kind of akin to that, because I'm sure it must exist in some form in other places too.
And this is kind of why, you know, Paul Krugman is talking about, it's blue America that's being gentrified. Yeah. And it's blue America that is, you know, still voting, even in a Democratic state, still voting to keep these things.
Yeah. And that's the thing too that's so funny about Democrats being like, well, we're not the racist ones. The Republicans are super racist and the Democrats are the party of anti-racism. It's like, look at your fucking public schools. Look at where you live. Look at where your money goes. Like, look at how you're voting to keep this shit that, like, absolutely decimates the public schools where you send your kid to private schools. Like, liberals have this idea that because, like, ideologically, maybe they think this way, that everything that they do is in accordance with that, when, like, no, it's not.
And think how much that builds generational wealth too. You know, if you are a family, if you get a house passed down to you and you live in California and you're still paying 1976 taxes on it, think about how much money you're saving.
Yeah.
Then you get to keep or pass down to your family members. Well, if somebody who is lower income tries to buy a house that is, like, sold by a previous owner, they have to pay these insane property taxes. Prop 13, people have written books about it. People have written theses about it. I don't know the specifics of it. And so if you guys know more about Prop 13 and want to tell us about it, that would be great. But I do know that it basically fucked the housing market. And now rich people aren't paying taxes on properties that they've owned for a really long time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fucked up. It, like, makes me very sad. And I feel, yeah, but I try not to feel helpless, because there are things that we all can do. Like, again, we've discussed, if you have the money to not live, I mean, I'm sure there are places that are, like, cooler and more trendy because they're actively being gentrified. But if you have the money to choose to not move into a place like that, like, that's a decision that you can make.
Absolutely.
If you are strapped for fucking cash and you need to move to a place that's going to be affordable and you kind of don't have a choice, like, that might be something that you have to do. But that doesn't mean that, like, that makes you complicit. Like, you know, even, it wasn't for a few months after I moved into my East Hollywood place that I realized, like, oh man, I should really start, you know, putting my money into the local businesses versus, like, the Target or the Vons or whatever. And I started going to more of, like, the family-owned grocery stores. And then I got to, like, know my neighbors more and, like, met the people who do that. Like, I don't go to Goodwill anymore because there are two ladies on my street who, like, sell clothes on the sidewalk every Saturday. And, like, I meet those neighbors. And, like, if you're going to be involved in any kind of, like, mutual aid organization, look for ones that help people in your community, you know, and just, these are ways that you can try to get involved in your community. And really, the big thing is, I mean, the problem is that the money is leaving the community. So if there are ways that you can invest back in the community and just like support those businesses and support those people, that is one way to be an active community member in addition to getting involved in mutual aid, looking at, especially in LA, like looking at where the street sweeps are around your neighborhood, because like I know and have like become familiar with like some of the unhoused people that live by me. And like, I'm kind of always like on the lookout for when their shit's getting swept by the city. Right. And like, there are a bunch of like Street Watch LA. If you're in LA specifically, that's a really good one to follow. But just making sure that you are really putting in your time, because of course there are things that are out of our control in terms of where we can afford to live, but it's not out of our control what kind of community member we decide to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the rich need to be taxed insanely more than they are. I mean, it's ridiculous, like the taxes that, and especially because like inflation has gone up so much, and like, you know, the prices of things have gone up exponentially, but the salaries have not gone up for like middle class people to match those prices. Right. Our generation cannot afford houses because the comparison of how much people get paid to how expensive houses are is so exponentially, like there's a much bigger gap between, like, it was like $50,000 for a house back in the day, you know? And if crazy. You're getting paid a salary that matches up with that, then it's very affordable to buy a house and then sell that house and get generational wealth. Like,
and I will just really stress, if you are especially a white person moving into a gentrifying space, like being a good community member is so important. I remember I was reading another mailbox moment where this girl was walking with her friend who like moved into like a very gentrified building in the middle of this place. And the girl basically said things like, yeah, it's crazy. Like, such a nice building for such like a shit place. And like, I like kind of hate this neighborhood, but like, I love the building. And like, that's not being a fucking good community member. Like, don't move into your big high rise and go to Lululemon and go to your coffee shop every day. Like, really explore what the community was like before you moved in there and before you started like being a part of changing it and displacing people, and seeing what there is for you to do to uplift that community and to really put your money back into it is what's most important.
And what all these, you know, the mailbox moments were telling us too is that like there's so much culture. I mean, even in like the architecture, like LA has such unique architecture. It has such like, you know, a Spanish influence on the architecture. There are all these places that like are so unique that if those areas are gentrified or those people are forced to move out, it completely destroys the culture and the uniqueness of that area.
Totally.
And it's so important to preserve those communities, because they create diversity, they maintain language, they maintain all these things that like, if we live in a homogenous society, like nobody is gonna get.
Yeah.
Like if they just move the same Whole Foods into every neighborhood, like you lose these unique stories and these unique like cultural elements that are really important to keep. If we really do believe that America is like a melting pot of different cultures, then we can't just replace, you know, these communities with like homogenous, like corporate shit that you can find anywhere in America.
Yeah. Exactly. And especially being so atomized, as young people are increasingly apt to do because of the direction and the downward spiral of capitalism, like really getting involved with your community, knowing your neighbors, can help you feel more a part of things and can really help improve your like experience in a place as well.
And I think that's another thing that like so often people in cities don't feel that sense of community, because there is no connection between any of that.
Totally. And there's a lot of fear mongering about the types of people that are outside and like the types of people that live in certain areas that stops people from like creating real connections and feeling as if they're a part of a community.
Yeah. Anyway, we hope that you guys found this episode interesting. We would love to hear your opinions on gentrification. And also, I'm very interested in Prop 13. So I want to hear if some of you like work on that or know more about it. I'm sure that we got some things wrong in this episode, but it's a really important issue. And I think it's really interesting to think about, as like the homelessness crisis is getting worse and the housing market is, you know, constantly changing. Like, these are things that are important to think about, because it's cultures that are actively like getting erased and communities that are getting erased, that especially during the pandemic, like we can't be losing these things that are so important to what America technically should be or is in idea.
Totally.
Anyway, we have to thank our godly wives.
Godly wives. Thank you so much for being here. You are a cornerstone of the Binchtopia community, and you could never gentrify because you belong here. Thank you so much to Tess Williams, Nicole Pearl, Ruth Curry, Kinsey Williamson, Catherine Noble, Summer, Anna Hayslip, Tiffany Enderby, Layla Elgasab, Hannah James, Caledonia Strelo, Katie Mansky, Mary Blodgett, Liliana Talamantes, Julia Perez, Claire Carter, and Serene. I think I'm getting faster at this.
You are.
Thank you so much, ladies.
Also, I think that today is Nicole Pearl's birthday. So
stop. Let me check. Let
by
me double
the time
check
Nicole
this.
Pearl hears this, it won't be her birthday. But everybody, wish happy belated birthday to our queen,
our
Nicole
queen,
Pearl.
Nicole Pearl, happy birthday! You literally hold up the sky.
We love you.
We love you.
Bye.
We hope you enjoy your stay.